What are those?
Just
historic papers.
Fantastic. Yes, they are indeed. What will you do with those? Donate those to the Imperial War Museum or the RAF Museum or something?
It's really grand sums of
things. Yes. Well, that's the sort of thing, really. Oh, it should go in a museum, isn't it?
Yes. You, of course, were flying. What were you flying?
Well, I finished up on Liberators.
Did you really?
In the last war.
Well, in daylight?
Yes, that's right. In the far, well, it wasn't really, because I was in the Far East campaign, and there was nothing at all compared.
Well, this was, of course, one of our bombers. Now, this is written by Cambrai, who was here he is, standing up there. Now this is the point, you see, we had, it was a pusher with a Rolls Royce V8 cylinder. I had a 325 horsepower Rolls Royce, most of them were 250 horsepower. That's why I went out to Bristol Fighters.
Yes.
But I didn't do anything really like Bristol Fighters. But you see, there's the pilot, there's the poor observer. He's not strapped in or anything.
Isn't he really?
Oh no. Oh. And here he is, standing up like that, firing backwards over the top, you see, with this gun up on the post.
Gosh.
And he fired, of course, this is an ordinary Jefferson gun firing weapon. And the pilot, we had a fixed Vickers gun firing forward. So we got pretty good firepower for 1917. They put the wind up there. FETV, besides its ugly appearance, was wonderfully strong. These, there are, there's E.T. Stevens from Cambrai, that's the fellow who wrote this article. I've got an actual copy of that photograph, if you're interested. The actual one. Took it because of the FETVs and showed it close to mine, blown up by sappers. They've got that now, they've buried 8,000 Germans in that one. I went up there the night of the afterwards and saw them. Look, there's the one up the front.
Did you?
Oh, yes.
You mean by foot sort of thing?
Well, no, we'd take a tender, and then when we'd walk when we got to the communication trenches. I remember being shot down once. When I say shut down, Buckingham smashed my propeller. Took one blade off of that, locked the engine, and I switched off quickly and tipped it right on its side. And I managed to just go over the top of the lines and landed in a shell. I pancaked it right down to the great big shell hole. And as I was a pancake, within, I should say, 30 seconds the Germans were shooting at us and firing us, you couldn't see.
What was this, small arms fire or artillery?
Oh no, shells.
Yeah.
Oh well, anyway, there were two communication trenches. My observer jumped into one and I jumped into the other. And I wasn't quite sure which side of the lines we were. So I went very gingerly in those broken flying boots down this communication trench. So I heard voices coming up from a dugout. They were Scotsmen. So I got lost with them for an hour or two. I had all jumps get away. So I came down to the end of the communication trench and came to a road. And as I was walking along this, I'd inquired which was the way to the nearest casualty clearing depot. And walking along this road, gaily, all of a sudden, I went flat on the face, a battery of our guns were on the other side of the hedge, and they saw me coming, they fired over the top of me in the bus. They're laughing like that. Anyway, I eventually turned up at this casualty clearing station to find my observer already there, sitting down very gaily drinking tea. We were reported missing. We didn't get back for 24 hours. It was funny.
Tell me, Mr. Satchel, after the war, what did you do, if you don't mind my asking you?
Well, I didn't leave the service until, I think it was September 1919. Mm. So the war had ended in November 1918. And I was given command of a training depot station, they call it those days. Training depot squadron. I forget whether I was 8 or 12, but there were two on Netheravon Aerodrome, just over here. One was commanded by a chap named Lloyd, Hugh Pugh Lloyd, and one was commanded by yours truly. We had a very nice hut, or a commanding officer's hut, they called it. We had a separate bedroom, a communal lounge, the bathroom. But one night we sat down and we said, what are you going to do here? Oh, incidentally, I was 2 weeks senior to you, so I commanded the station. That was one of the jokes. And he said, well, I don't know. I got no idea. I said, well, I've got an offer of a student apprenticeship in a very good engineering firm in Brackley. I'm going to take it. I said, all I've got here is an offer for 4 years, temporary commission. That's what they offered us. He had got so long. So I said, I'm going up to see the wing commander. So off I went. Charming fellow. I went into the office and moved away. Just received an offer for 4 years commission. I said, that's no use to me. I don't want to be in or I want to be out. He says, don't get excited, Satchel. And he opened his door. He said, I've got one too. Anyway, I said, I've decided to leave. But he said, I can't stop you. I said, well, okay, if I go tomorrow, he said, yes. So I went. Then I got back to Rugby. There was that was my hometown, incidentally, Rugby. And this was the British Thompson Houston, this is where, you see. And I'd been clocked in for them before the war broke out. If I needed an interview, and I went to check out, and I said, well, there's a engine drivers strike on, you know, goods train shifting, we can't start you until the strike's over. So I said, that's all right, I'm here, I'm a bit of a holiday. And in those days, Rugby was quite a centre for locomotives. I went to what they call the sheds, saw the boss of that, and I said, any chance of a job? He said, yes. You'd make a good stoker. So he said, well, come on. I didn't even go home. Put these overalls on, and I had a nice peak cap, London and North West. Started stoking down to Bletchley and back. And great big clawed engines, colossal fellows. Anyway, I hadn't been on that for more than 4 days, and they promoted me to driver. And I used to drive from Euston to Crewe, sleep in the quarters. The crews drivers in the lovely quarters there. Then take another train out the next morning to Euston, and then go backwards and forwards like that. Till the end of the strike. I managed to do Euston to Crewe. Of course, there were no signals were permanently set. All the signals were on strike. Permanently set on one track only. The only thing you had to do was to watch you didn't run into a train in front of you. But you used to do Euston to Crewe within 5 minutes of the usual time. Great fun. I always remember the day the strike ended. I didn't know it ended. I was at Euston. Camden Town was where they kept the engines and turned them around, you know. And I had to go out on. I always took the 8:30 out from Euston Crewe. And I was on. The boiler on top of the dig and the oil came. And I suddenly heard a voice, "Be careful you don't get yourself dirty, sir." What the devil happened? I looked at it. Was the strike, the driver had gone on strike return. The strike had ended that morning. And so he said, "Well, you've done all the work on it, so you can drive it up to Rugby and get them off, and I'll carry on." And that's where we ended up. A complete gentleman's strike. Well, I said, "Good luck to you. I believe you've won, haven't you?" I said, "Yes, well, you deserve every penny you've got." I said, "I'd had enough of it. Yeah, hard work."
Is it? I wouldn't know, but I'll take your word for it.
Well, the stoking was. You've got a 14-mile hill coming out of Euston, and of course they put a few extra carriages on. And crept over the top of it, and as you, the thing had to keep the steam pressure up. Yeah. That was the trouble. And the stoker, of course, had to stoke. You had to, if you just chucked the coal in, it went straight up the flue. You had to force it down, see? And the driver used to open the box just as you were ready to throw them. And that's how we got up there.
He did it.
I enjoyed that eventually. It was quite a nice thing to do.
What could you do after that then, Mr. Sampson?
Oh, when the strike ended, I was taken on by the works.
And you finished up in engineering?
Yes, I was on a 3-year apprenticeship, and after the end of the second year they decided to send me out to America.
Oh.
And I spent 13 months in America with the great General Electric Company.
Fantastic.
Yes. Including outside construction work, installing a vertical water wheel generator set, the first one installed in Quebec, up at Shawinigan Falls. And there was one other Englishman there, or one other man who spoke English, and all the rest were French Canadians who we had to train. The thing had been made in bits and was sent up in sections of stator and rotor we had to build up with all the quadrants on and that sort of thing. And we had to wind this stator. And who showed these French Canadians exactly how to do the job. You only got to show them once and they could do it better than you could yourself. And then it was a wonderful crowd of workmen in my life. We started work at 7 o'clock in the morning. We had half an hour break in the middle of the day. We went back to our log-built hotel. 10 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. And we all came to my room and we had sing songs till about midnight. We were down there at 10 o'clock next morning. We did the whole job in 9 weeks. And running round on the car in 9 weeks. It was the first vertical water wheel generator installed at Shawinigan Falls. It was a horizontal DC sets, the transmission lines were hundreds of cables, copper, nearly all copper, For the smelties. Anyway, this was the first vertical one we did. And this was, of course, AEC. But when I got back to England, having had this experience in America, they put me as the assistant superintendent of the winding department. I hadn't been there for more than about 6 months before they made me planning engineer. It was a new idea in those days. The first big job we had, of course, was introducing domestic appliances in 1930, because of the slump. We had a very fine chairman who gave us £60,000 to and put in two sizes of refrigerator, that's a hermetically sealed unit, two sizes of cookers, and a washing machine, which is known as the Maytag, an American machine. I passed over to America. From General Electric. We had those all in production in 7 months. Wow. And when we got the bill, it was £66,000, and I thought I was going to get the sack. Because it was £6,000 I would spend. And so it was and that went on, and that was Hot Point Company. That was the start, the end of the Hot Point Company. We made the radio heater, we called them tunnels, we called them cow rods in the circulating. The first one, but that was the start. And that went on until the outbreak of the war. Well, just before the outbreak of the war, Chairman said, "Believe, essentially, you've got to stop domestic appliances instantly." Oh, he says, "Don't worry about that. We'll be taken over by the Admiralty. We've got to start making predictors and torpedoes and everything under the sun." That's a model of torpedo given to me by the Navy.
That's interesting. Can I have a look at it?
Yes, that's an electric. Thank you. see.
You know that advance?
Yes.
When the